This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So, all right, thank you all for joining me to talk about your book, the lab book, Situated Practices in Media Studies. I guess to kick things off, I'd love to have you all introduce yourselves and then describe kind of how you all know each other and describe the idea for where this book came from. We'll go in alphabetical order. So how about Darren, we'll start with you.
Okay, I'm Darren Werschler. I'm a professor at Concordia University in Montreal. I do most of my work at the Milieu Institute, which is a media arts institute at Concordia. And inside that, I started a space called the Residual Media Depot, which is one of the largest collections in the country of historical video game equipment and all of the things that you need in order to make that work with current consoles. And I mean, Laurie and I have known each other since we were graduate students together, and I met UC at 2012 at the media at the network archaeologies conference. So yeah,
shall I go next? Am I in the next in alphabetical order? So yeah, my name is Jussi Parikka. I work at Aarhus University in Denmark now as professor of digital aesthetics and culture. I've was in the UK for about 16 years and also involved in all kinds of dialogues with both Darren and Laurie over the years. It's good that you were able to remember, Darren, when we met for the first time, because I also feel that with both of you, Laurie and Darren, we've been in dialogue for ages, and some of that fed into our book, but also we've been involved in shared research conversations on all kinds of topics on digital culture, experimental methods, media archaeology, and so forth as well. And I'm sure that we'll talk about the book soon, but I'll hand it over to Laurie.
I'm Laurie Emerson. I'm a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder, and I am in the media studies department here. And I direct a PhD program called Intermedia Art, Writing, and Performance. And I also direct the Media Archaeology Lab, which I started in 2009. So it's been a long journey. And I'm glad Darren and UC can remember when we went, because I don't really remember. It's been that long. But I do have a very clear memory of Twitter playing a really important role, like Twitter in the early years between like 2009 and I don't know, maybe 2015. And I think the three of us had a lot of conversations on Twitter relating to Kittler and media archaeology and labs. And I have a hunch that played a big role in us coming together finally to propose this book, which I think was in 2016.
Yeah. Yeah. We there was that conference here in Montreal that UC was at, and we started talking then. There were bits and pieces of things that I was writing for that talk that found their way into the lab book. But part of the problem for all of us was just that labs were in the air at the time. You couldn't turn around without falling into a conversation about labs. My dean wanted to talk about labs. The vice president of research wanted to talk about labs. This whole kind of contingent of people who had been in the poetry world and had drifted into media studies wanted to talk about labs. The media archaeology people wanted to talk about labs. And the implicit question hanging in the background is, what does that even mean? So, and it literally took us years to sort of feel our way through that, to just figure out what our research object was.
Exactly. I think I too.
And...
Oh, go ahead, Lucy.
No, Laurie, go ahead.
Oh, I think I too was looking for a way to try to historicize and theorize where my own lab came from and where its place was in the landscape of labs. And this was after years of being in meetings with university higher-ups who were often in the sciences and would declare with certainty that my lab wasn't a lab. Or that my lab didn't count as a lab. And of course, that frustrated me. And I was, you know, keenly aware that all of us were working in labs to some degree and needed the intellectual scaffolding to justify what we were doing to some extent.
Mm. So in many ways, I think we were all involved in somewhat internal discussions within our universities, and that was part of the reflection in terms of what is a lab from the point of view of administration and from the point of view of a particular research and teaching infrastructure. And I'm curious to ask you both about the role of collections in terms of your labs, but before that as well, the idea of the internal discussions many of us had, and then also the ways in which that really interesting tension between academic labs and the legacy of them, history of science and history of engineering, but also there's just the pure, you know, sheer inflation of the term across the board, which is in an interesting contrast with the fact that, like, the heavy investment into the notion of the lab, and also for good reasons, and the particular humanities lab traditions, but then also the fact that, you know, there's all kinds of labs, brew labs, coffee labs, design labs, of all kinds of things, that is sort of a hazy background against which we were really invested in trying to grow out this party. I wonder if this is the good time to ask you two to talk a bit about that, because I think that one of the things that is interesting is the relation to collections, and that was perhaps driving at least some of the ways in which your lab slash the depot were also building itself. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the collection question, the research collection question, is one of those side conversations that we had at some point in the middle, and I ended up actually teaching a graduate seminar called The Research Collection, as a way to try to figure out that as a problem. And collections were something that were very much a part of university life in the late 19th century, and then they kind of faded out. And certainly Laurie and I were in the process of building collections so that we could talk about things. And that was always the problem for many of the scholars that I knew, was they wanted to talk about things that the university was unequipped to talk about. So you actually had to build the collection in the first place, even in order to understand what the conversation was going to be about. I'm sure that sounds familiar to Laurie.
Yeah, 100%. And I think too, we really had to work on, and this is probably already what you're saying, Darren, we had to work on creating the rhetoric around collections so that people just didn't think about it as a museum. And to this day, I have a really hard time trying to make people understand that the collection of objects in the lab is not, it's not museum quality. It's not meant to be like preserved forever. And librarians have a really hard time understanding this, or at least the ones that I deal with here at CU Boulder. They're wonderful people, but their understanding of the role of a collection in a university is very different than mine.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I imagine if we were talking to archaeologists or geologists, it'd be an easier conversation, because those are the kinds of places that research collections persisted. even at University of Toronto, they have a collection of scientific instruments, but it's much more that kind of white glove, hands-off model of how you collect things. Although, as I understand it, even the Smithsonian is moving away from that because they simply can't afford to maintain collections in that way. So everything is becoming more hands-on and people are just saying, look, we might as well actually let people interact with these things in order to understand how they work. And I think that, you know, UC can talk about this, but that's an important principle in the work of Wolfgang Ernst, the idea that you have to actually make something operate if you want to understand what it does. You can't just look at it from a distance.
Mm. This was exactly at the back of my head as well, that besides the sort of infrastructure that you two are hosting and have been maintaining and caring for as well, there's these certain examples that feature in our book quite prominently and also by colleagues whose work has been influential in one way or another. And that would be, for instance, Wolfgang Ernst, German media scholar and theorist, who is one of the people behind the so-called media archaeological fundus, or the media archaeological cellar, or perhaps a lab. We probably pitch it as a lab of sorts for those reasons mentioned, that they really wanted to build this kind of research and teaching collection as well that has a relation to old media technological instruments as a way of grounding a particular theoretical investigation into operationality. And the idea that already sort of speaks to a lot of topics going on in media studies, which is one of the fields we share, the three of us as well, is media studies. Even whether we are, always have been, or I'm not in a media studies department, and Laurie hasn't always been, and we all have kind of a very different relations also to media studies, but still it's one of the fields where we articulate things. So the idea that, you know, to investigate media, we don't investigate it only as a removed, distanced object, as a text, for instance, either. I mean, not that we are against text, but, you know, both of you work with text in many kinds of ways. But the idea that the materiality of media in process needs to be the fundamental basis through which we start unfolding also technical media culture. And that sort of demands just a simple thing, that you actually have to then have an access to opening up devices, to reverse engineering in some cases, whether it's something that relates to software, or in many of the cases that we're interested in, also into hardware and circuits. So a lot of these sort of cross-disciplinary ways of engaging with what is often seen as quote-unquote just technology is central to our interest, I guess, in collections as well as indeed hands-on.
Yeah, I feel like, I guess you mentioned that, like, there's this maybe divide between like what you think of as the scientific lab and this more media studies kind of more broad definition of what a lab is. And I come from a scientific background, and just like you describing, like, oh, like you can't just archive something, you need to like engage with it to understand it. Like, that's exactly what you do in a science lab. You're not just like standing there and like not touching the instruments. Like, you have to use them to make new knowledge and understand the world. So I guess that's maybe a side note, but I guess I'm kind of curious as to how you kind of went about creating like the lab collection that you sort of describe in this book. Like in this book, you have like many case studies. So like how did you go about like collecting the labs that you ended up describing here?
Sheer audacity.
That's a great method.
In order to make these kinds of spaces work at all, you basically have to proceed as though you have permission and do it before anyone finds out, which is complicated because it involves a lot of social engineering. You need to find a space. You need to find money for stuff. You need to find money for people to work with the stuff. And then once you've got it all in place, you have to know what's there. So there's a lot of cataloging and handling. And then you have to figure out, you know, what your problem is evolves as you're doing all of this. Like, all of the questions that start to emerge when you start to collect things will start to shape how the collection moves. And you start to realize, well, Laurie's doing this, so I'm not going to do this. And Wolfgang Ernst does this, so I'm not going to do this. So the trajectory that develops is partly about paying attention to what other people are doing, but it's this really complicated dance, you know, where you're trying to make something work in a space that you're really not supposed to.
Yeah, that's well put. Sorry, go ahead, Yuzi.
No. You should jump in, really, as, again, somebody who's hands-on with the collections of, you know, hands-on collections.
Well, yeah. I completely agree with everything Darren was saying. And I think over the years, I've come to understand that what's made my lab successful, and I'm not sure whether this applies to all labs, but being open to the lab sort of having a life of its own, actually. If I had set out in 2009 with, you know, a very rigid 5-year plan of what I wanted the lab to accomplish, and if I had had a very carefully delineated plan of what sorts of things we collect and what sorts of things we don't, I think it just wouldn't be the interesting, lively, vital place that it is. So there's this really interesting dance constantly between what I do to direct the lab and the things that I'm interested in, and what the collection itself sort of invites us to do, and the sorts of people that become attracted to the lab and then start donating things. So the life of the lab has a life of its own. But I did also want to mention that early on in the process, I think we had a sense of ourselves as very loosely doing a kind of ethnography of media labs around the world in general. And so other than what we're doing with our own labs, we did a lot of work to send out interview questions and surveys to as many people as we could, to ask them to answer questions about their own labs. And my memory is that we got something like 60 to 80 responses from people around the world, and then we collected them all on our own little independent WordPress site. Mm. And I think that is a lot of how we came to develop the hybrid lab model. It's just like, after reading all of the responses and collating it, the hybrid lab model is what emerged.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there are too many labs to produce a statistically significant sample of anything. Even like the studies of science labs that have been conducted by, you know, people like Michael Crow say this. So if our research object was the things that were excluded from all of those studies, how could we possibly produce a representative sample? So then the problem became, okay, what we actually need is, given the fact that most of the people that we're interested in are automatically excluded from consideration by all of the people, you know, saying to Lori, saying to me, this isn't a lab, the problem then becomes, how does one talk about that? And I think that's how we kind of eventually, you know, sort of fumbled our way toward developing a method or a heuristic for people to actually talk about the kinds of labs that they were making and the kinds of knowledge claims that they wanted to be able to make with those labs. So the nature of the problem changed once we discovered that we couldn't actually, you know, describe in a representative way the thing that we wanted to talk about in the first place.
Yeah.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And I guess that sort of speaks to the hybridity of the hybrid lab as one axis around which we didn't want to speak only about humanities labs or media labs, but the ways in which it cross-disciplinarity works by way of these spatial institutional settings, but not only cross-disciplinarity in the sort of a usual generic way, but all kinds of modes of thinking and theorizing in relation to thinking and making in terms of collecting and all kinds of verb forms that sort of really define the laboratory as a set of activities. So again, for instance, the legacy of critical making, both in media studies and design, was one axis around which we had interesting conversations with colleagues in labs. Sometimes these labs were called labs, sometimes they were called something else, as well as other forms of activity that we really tried to gather around this general term of the hybrid lab as such.
I think I'll implore listeners to check out the book to identify the categories that you end up choosing for the extended lab model. But I think I would love to ask the question. You talk a lot about like the role of the university, and even like you've all already mentioned that that you needed to feel like you felt like you needed to make the case for your university that like your labs were actually labs. You had this like intuitive sense of like, yes, what I'm doing is legitimate and it should be like that meta analysis of like what I'm doing is valid and I need to kind of prove that to my university. But then you also in many times throughout the book, you describe like the role even before, you know, to have made this book, the role of the university in a lab existed. So I guess I'm just curious as to maybe you can, it's a huge question to say the role of the university in a lab, but you know, there's like the business relationship with it and like the power relationship and authority of a university over a lab and vice versa. So I guess maybe I'll just leave that an open-ended thing for you to maybe comment on.
If I start with something, because I never ran a lab myself. I, with colleagues when I was in the UK, we had a research unit, a research center of sorts, although called on archaeologies of media and technology, where we didn't do collections. We were flirting with the idea of building a collection, but what's significant about the work we did from our perspective and what it helped, for instance, me personally as well, is not just to focus on the notion of the lab, literally, but any kinds of infrastructural negotiations, bureaucratic negotiations, practices of naming, and what kind of practices get picked up and what kind of practices float somewhere under the sort of radar, so to speak. And this was the significant part of the discussions as well, beyond the lab as such. There are different university systems where we come from and work in. And for me as well, there's different hierarchies. What is really, what's the sort of a like level of university infrastructures that comes with the budget line? What's the sort of a thing that nobody cares about and you can name it as whatever it is because it doesn't have a budget, but you work as you know, in kind contributions of your time, for instance, and paying attention to these aspects in relation to also questions of labor, for instance, of remuneration and whose labor gets acknowledged, who doesn't, is part of the drill of how this becomes itself a way of investigation of those environments, whether they're spatial or whether they are more abstract, that sort of formulate the university.
I think for me, it's a really interesting, complex question about the role of universities, but I have come to understand that my way of thinking is feminist and it's materialist. And so in that sense, my thinking about labs doesn't start from an abstraction. It doesn't start from an abstract idea of what a lab is or what a lab should do. It starts with a very specific material context and situatedness, as Donna Haraway put it. And so, you know, over the years, I've been asked to give workshops and talks on how to help other people start labs, as if there's like a pre-existing set of things that everybody needs. But I think what I found, and probably Darren and UC as well, is that everything is entirely dependent on the very specific location that the lab is in. And I've seen this play out over the years, that the media archaeology lab wouldn't be what it is if it were at a different campus. And, you know, the University of Colorado administration has changed over the years. Its values, its what it promotes and what it doesn't promote has changed, and that has affected our funding, which of course has a profound effect on what the lab can do. The way we have tried to at various times make ourselves obvious on campus or more covert also is very dependent on university policy administration, but also the location of the university. It's in Boulder, Colorado. And so the demographics here skew heavily toward white middle class or upper middle class people. And there's a huge, very influential tech community here as well that's constantly influencing university funding and university projects. So, yeah.
Yeah, Lori's completely right. Which university you're trying to do what in matters an enormous amount. But beyond that, certainly in the humanities, it's impossible to build a lab and ignore the fact that you're going to have conversations about administration. You're going to have conversations about policy. So we wanted to make sure when we started to diagram this all out, that that was a really explicit part of what we were doing. In some ways, Canada is a very small place. Like the moment that you start doing something, the ripples go out very, very quickly. Firstly, because there are probably only like five people across the country who are doing anything even remotely similar to what you're doing. But what that means in turn is that it's actually fairly easy to have a conversation with government. You know, like if you want to talk to somebody about why policy is the way that it is, you phone them and then you have lunch on Thursday if you're in Central Canada, or you have a Zoom. Like it's not hard. So the difficulty is making the levers move, like actually affecting policy. But, you know, as Lori said, if your argument is material and grounded, you can speak with a little bit more knowledge about what it is that you're trying to do. It's not just polemic. It's not just conjecture. It's not just opinion. You know, it comes out of some kind of considered method for why you think something should be the way that it is.
Yeah. One of the things that sort of also for me, from my direction, overlaps and what was interesting as part of the whole process of our years of conversations and building and writing the book is that I was working in art school, in an art school as part of a science-led university, University of Southampton as well. And that was an interesting sort of a counterpoint, but perhaps a point of reflection in terms of different sort of a humanity spaces as well. So on the one hand, the levels of analyzing the bureaucratic mechanisms through which particular institutions and infrastructures are born, or sometimes objected, you know, objections to them, but also the concrete spatialities of universities and creative design and arts institutions is another thing. A really sort of a simple example is the concept of the studio, the idea of a studio as a particular kind of an affordance of space that, and within a university especially, that has a different dynamic than a classroom and a different dynamic than some other sort of university spaces. And that to me was a fascinating way of thinking about collaboration, thinking about dynamics of interaction, the ways in which teaching was organized slightly differently. My office was always next to undergraduate sculpture studio, and that just observing in a way, very casually, informally, it wasn't a really methodological observation, but just the ways in which that those classes worked was to me fascinating as part of this drill of thinking through literally also architecture and space as part of how universities function.
Yeah, we're all kind of deeply nerdy in an historical way about these issues. And when we started reading, you know, the long history of laboratories, you find out something very quickly, because, you know, part of what's underlying what UC is talking about is we tend to think about labs and art studios as opposites. But if you look at the history of it, you know, like the Gallison and Jones work that was done on labs and studios suggests that they both come from an industrial factory model. They're not opposites. They're, you know, different forks of the same thing. So when we started to think about space, and Laurie started to dig back even deeper, you know, into like medieval history and architecture and monasteries and all of that kind of stuff, our whole notion of how we were going to go about doing this and the received history of it started to change.
Mm. Yeah, I feel like that's really interesting about like, kind of like that, like aesthetics or like the architecture of these different spaces and how that influences how things are related. I think that kind of gets to like a question that I had about like, just like infrastructure is hard to perceive, even though it's like one of those things that's just like, you don't really notice infrastructure unless it's like not working. So, I just was just wondering how you go about like measuring that sort of like more kind of like, it's not a gut feeling, but like just like hard to measure things of like aesthetics and infrastructure.
Well, yeah, with you go ahead, Tara.
Well, I was just going to say, I live in the capital city of infrastructure that doesn't work. Like Montreal is continually breaking. So all of these things are visible. I'm surrounded by failed modernism all the time. Maybe part of what makes it easier is you start thinking, oh yeah, well that's broken and that's broken and that's broken, but it's all connected, and you know, connected badly in kinds of weird ad hoc ways. But again, like you start to think about method and you know, all of the assumptions that we make about how, you know, science labs actually work and how, you know, how knowledge is produced and how much failure is involved every day when you walk into a lab. I was talking to a writer whose background, he has a PhD in marine biology, and he was talking about his postdoc, and he said, look, every day for a year during my entire postdoc, I would go into the lab and I would do an experiment and it would fail over and over and over again. So, you know, like that in some respects, like, and you know, you were asking earlier about lab imaginaries, so maybe that's something that UC can talk about, but we do have this sense that science labs are this, you know, incredibly precise functional thing that, you know, just extrudes knowledge from it, and it's not like that at all. But the important thing is that we imagine that that's how it works.
True. One of the key terms in our field, and broadly in science and technology studies, has been the method of infrastructural inversion. And that speaks quite directly to this point of how to shift perspective in analysis to the sort of a work of what conditions, for instance, lab work, what conditions this abstract formation of knowledge, what conditions these imaginaries even as well. And that sort of became one way of narrating it from the sort of really, you know, nuts and bolts of things that are, you know, hard infrastructure, right? Whether it would be actual technologies that define a particular lab, like a 3D printer, which was the fab at one point, was the trend that, you know, you needed to have a 3D printer in your sort of a humanities labs to make it slightly different than the labs where you actually have just books and pens and pencils and whatnot, the traditional humanities tools. And to the sort of work that we've been already talking, I mean, the sort of areas that we've been talking about, in other words, the sort of abstract paperwork of different sorts, all kinds of lists and policy and manifestos and gray literature that sort of functions also as an infrastructure of sorts in those terms, and or than a budget line. Budgets themselves are infrastructures of sorts of conditioning something, and that is sort of again the axis of the whole book and our interest, like both Laurie and Darren have been also narrating, is that we really are interested in questions of materiality, but also in these questions of imaginaries. And sometimes these things stick together as well, but sometimes they rub off against each other and there's a massive tension. Like, for instance, in the imaginary of the white lab coat, sort of a infused science lab of thing to the actual reality of what labs are about, beyond the formalities into the sort of informalities. And this is not just a thing where we as humanities scholars come to say that, look, but this is exactly like, you know, look at this, all kinds of like cultural aspects. This has been also realized in a lot of the scientific context, including in literature that pertains to particular ways of building architectures for science labs and taking into account what are the spaces in between, not just the lab itself, but what are the spaces of corridors, cafeterias, and other forms of again, space, constructed space that, you know, allows encounters of a different, you know, sometimes accidental sort.
I think two fields that strangely don't seem to be in conversation with each other very often are infrastructure studies and media archaeology. But media archaeology has had a huge influence, at least on me, and how I think about infrastructure in terms of that one line of thinking of media archaeology that's invested in peeling away the layers to get at the underlying function of a piece of technology or media. And so in terms of getting at the invisibility of infrastructure, I always think of it in terms of peeling away the layers of, could be policy, or the layers of space to try to get at the underlying assemblage, maybe I could say.
Yeah, at one point in the book, you like note that you're like writing it during like the midst of COVID and like the Black Lives Matter protests. And you have this quote that it's like become an important reminder of the stakes of people in institutional practices. The question of what forms of knowledge are being legitimized needs to be complemented with the question of who is being legitimized. And I think, end quote. And I think that, you know, one of the conclusions that you have in this book is that like hybrid labs like need the community and commitment of like institutions, of people, of infrastructure, of policy. And I guess I'm just curious as to how you think there can be more community and more support and more commitment from these different like branches and levels to achieve that, to like have a more, I don't know, balance is the right word, but more holistic or something. I'm not quite sure the word, but just like a more like well-rounded like concept of lab and of even just like scholarly pursuits. That's a huge question too. But
well, I mean, there was a whole movement about a decade ago around what were called living labs. And, you know, the idea is much older. Like you can go back to the 1960s, and the idea of a city as a laboratory that starts to emerge out of the hippie movement. Like people are already talking about that. To try to look at the way that knowledge is produced collectively in some kind of bounded physical space, it's a larger problem than what happens in a room in a university. And part of the point of the work on people is that, you know, we can imbue things with agencies and things can measure stuff for us, but the people are also part of that whole assembly of things that are, you know, involved in the process of making knowledge. And habitually, all kinds of people get excluded or included for weird and arbitrary reasons. You know, as a humanities scholar, every time I look at a publication in science and there's 17 graduate students listed as co-authors on the end, that's a convention of acknowledging people that may or may not have had anything to do with the production of the work. Like, you don't really know who did the actual work. It's a mystery, but it's a different model of authorship and a different model of giving credit than the one that we use. You know, and it can be just as problematic to produce research under one name and then say, well, you know, who kept the lights on? Who did the work? Who cleaned the room? You know, like, because all of those things are also important. So starting to think about all, you know, these other kinds of models that have been around for much longer, where there's like at least an attempt, even if it an imperfect one, to you know, account for the people that are involved in producing knowledge. I think that that's really important.
I think something to add on to what Darren is saying is that there are two things that work in tandem, I think, in really important ways to nurturing, creating community in and through labs. And that's, I don't have a word for it, but maybe you could call it clear boxing as the opposite of black boxing. So always a commitment and a dedication to transparency about who's doing what, transparency about labor roles, transparency about funding, where your funding comes from, how you're using it, transparency about how you run meetings, transparency about your policies, all kinds of things. Because the opposite of that to me is, at least I can say, a former incarnation of the MIT Media Lab, where there's a lot of gestures towards transparency. There's glass everywhere, as if everything is perfectly clear to everybody. But in fact, it's absolutely the opposite. And the other thing that works in tandem, I think, with clear boxing is just lowering barriers to access as much as possible, and trying to, I know it sounds a little soft and mushy, but trying to make people feel welcome who would normally think that they don't belong in a lab, or that they don't have the skills or the expertise to be in a lab. And so something I've been working on with Libby for years is just running workshops and events to for people that have never picked up a soldering iron, or for people who never thought that they could create a mini FM transmitter, and so on.
Yeah, exactly. Those aspects of really genuine inclusivity that are aware of the various sort of axes of power that work within and outside institutions like universities is crucial. And this is obviously the point where it again applies that it's not just about labs. This is about any kind of work environment in which we work at universities as well. That's one aspect. And the other one is what we're doing, for instance, in Aarhus next week. Beyond the topic of labs, there's I'm organizing with colleagues a workshop where we're looking into the sort of a complicity of university infrastructures with big tech, and the ways in which the infrastructure is built up beyond the sort of a like otherwise publicly funded democratic institutions into this sort of privatization of data streams. And one of my sort of like pet topics of past years and many of ours as well is the complicity of universities in relation to the military industrial complex, which of course in North America is central, but looking at, for instance, even cases like Denmark, it's our university's relation to providing certain technological know-how to Israeli defense forces is a point where we need to be aware of the multiple scales of our sort of links to providing a proper ethical atmosphere, both within the institution and beyond it.
Yeah, that's huge. I feel like that kind of gets back into what you were talking about earlier, about like, kind of like the role of university in terms of like where budget and sort of like how that's like proportional to value, and, you know, like the kind of like the pros and cons of having those relations with like government funding is like in that case of like funding war basically, and, you know, but how that can, you know, also, you know, benefit like really interesting research. Like there's so much basic research that, you know, also comes out of like defense budgets, and what do you do with that? That could be a place to stop. That's like a huge it could be like another 3-hour conversation, but I feel like and I know that we're running short of time, but I guess I know Lori had to hop, but you each kind of mentioned like transparency, and maybe I'll show my hand a little bit. I work for a publishing group, and I know you mentioned in your book that you also published this book on Manifold. So it's like an open access book. So I'm kind of curious to maybe we can like wrap up the conversation with like sort of why you chose to do that and how it's like this work is being engaged with that you know so far.
Well, I mean, academic publishing is different already from other kinds of publication because
for sure.
the profit motive isn't front and center. And as somebody who ran a book publishing company for 5 years, in Canada, at least, the idea that that's profitable is kind of a polite fiction. So you have to think differently about what. Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, sure. But there are other imaginaries available. And, you know, the interesting and gratifying thing is that none of us had any fear or stigma about digital publishing because we had all done it before and had been involved in it for decades. But, you know, again, what we know is that if you can actually, you know, intrigue people with something and get them interested in an idea by making the material available and making the research available. And again, like in Canada, there's a mandate for that. If your research is government funded, it has to be publicly available. So that was always part of the project, but there's no point in pretending that if you just cache it in a book that anything better is going to happen.
Yeah. And the platform was, in that sense, Manifold Platform has been, and, you know, the press support has been useful because it also allowed us to continue the book outside it coming out as a book and getting away from the traditional idea that, okay, we spend a certain amount of time, the book comes out and that's it, into this sort of a like, really think about what is a platform as a place of enabling further discussions. So we reached out to some of the communities that were already helping us when we were writing the book, but also then helping a chance to some other authors as well publish as part of the same framework of an extended version of it as well. So the Manifold Platform hosts some short texts that continue the discussion, point out where we didn't address certain themes or techniques of the lab, and then really sort of a like build it much beyond the authorship voice of us three into giving a sense of the other ways of engaging with this as well. So anyone who's listening and really interested, just go on Manifold and check out the sort of extended discussions of the techniques of the lab that others have proposed.
An extended lab model. I feel like that kind of like ties back into what you talked about at the beginning of just like having to, you know, you can't look at something from a distance. You have to like engage with it to really like understand it and make sense of it. So I think that's a very symbolic and meta level to end this conversation on. So I'll just thank you both, and to extend a thank you to Lori, who had to hop off, for having this conversation with me.
Thanks so much, Sarah.